Hi, I'm Bonnie Landry, and welcome to Make Joy Normal. With my co-hosts, Celia Smith and Christina, and the guests we have on our show, we would like to share the opportunity to walk with you while you try to make joy normal in your own life. We're so grateful for all the listeners and for all the questions and the comments that we get on our show. We're just so thankful that you are tuning in and you have a desire to make joy normal in your own life. As part of your daily walk, we hope that we can support you in this. We ask that if this has been valuable to you, that you share, like, or leave us a review. That's how we get the word out so that we can help others make joy normal too.
I had two, actually. One is Brave New Us, right. And that deals with bioethics in the light of faith,
okay.
Catholic faith. And the other one is called Mama Prays, which is kind of self-explanatory.
Okay. And it's a little 5-minute sort of encouragement and that,
yes,
sort of thing. Yeah, it's lovely. We'll talk about those in a little bit. Good afternoon to all my listeners. I want to welcome Samantha Stevenson with me today, who is a mom and a bioethicist. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here talking to a grown-up today.
I'm delighted. I know, yeah. I will start with a prayer, and then if I can ask you to first tell us a little bit about your family, and then if you could tell us a little bit about your work and your podcast and what you do before I sort of dive,
sure,
into my big questions. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, just ask you to be with us and guide our conversation in this really, really important conversation that affects family life in so many ways when we look to how we form and teach our children, especially as homeschooling parents. And bless Samantha and myself as we become ideally conduit for your love and your truth and your beauty. I just want to ask our Mother of Good Counsel to pray for us. And Patron of Chastity, St. Thomas Aquinas, pray for us. And Patron of Joy, St. Philip Neri, pray for us. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
I didn't know that St. Thomas was the patron of chastity. That is my husband's saint. I'm going to have to tell him. I don't know if he knows.
Oh, really? That's great. Yeah, I mean, he's a patron of a few things, but I was actually just explaining in a couple of episodes ago why I always ask his intercession, because, like, what does chastity have to do with homeschooling? I mean, it has to do with everything. But the reason in particular I ask for his intercession about that is because chastity is about self-control, and we as parents, mm-hmm, need so much self-control to be joyful, right? And so that was kind of, I had an opportunity, so I thought maybe I should explain why I'm asking for the intercession of a patron of chastity, because I feel like chastity, mm-hmm, of our, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, mouth is kind of an important part of the program, right? So I was hoping that you would just tell us a little bit first about your family, age your kids, and what you are up to.
Yeah, so I have 4 children, and my oldest is just about to turn 8. She turns 8 tomorrow, actually.
Wow.
And so 2 boys and 2 girls. And so I'm homeschooling the 2-3 oldest a little bit. I mean, homeschool with the preschooler is kind of like the 5 minutes a day that he wants to learn about letters. So,
yeah,
but he is wanting to at this point. So that's nice.
That's amazing.
So we live in just outside of Boise, Idaho. And that my husband works from home. He suffers through, and I like to say he's getting some time off purgatory, trying to work and listen to our chaos in the background.
Yeah,
that's our lives. They're a little bit chaotic, a little bit noisy, but beautiful and full
That's
of love.
Awesome. How old's your youngest?
She is almost 19 months.
Okay. Your kids are very similar, mm-hmm, ages to one of my daughters. She has a almost 8-year-old, and then she has a 5-year-old, 3-year-old, 1-year-old.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. They're all born in even years. So at some point, they're all,
okay,
you're some point during the year, they're all 2 years apart.
That's awesome. And so professionally, and about your podcast, so you are a bioethicist. So what drew you to that? I'm assuming you were raised Catholic.
Actually, I was a convert. So, that's, we can probably start there. So I became Catholic in college. And so my first love of the Catholic faith is spirituality and prayer. And that's kind of what drew me in, and the truth. And the truth converted me in my search, mm-hmm, for the truth. I grew up just a Lutheran, So that's a different kind. That's a Protestant Christian. So I already had some faith and prayer background, but I found, you know, the fullness of truth and the fullness of prayer in the Catholic Church. So that was my first love. And after college, I was teaching high school theology. I switched my major to theology and did my thesis on prayer. And then through after that, I had also taken so many bioethics classes that were cross-listed because I also loved the just the teaching of the Catholic Church on the nature of the human person and the questions that come up with bioethics, especially the things that I like to focus on, are these new emerging technologies, reproductive technologies, you know, gender identity stuff, things that are really changing the way that we think about what it means to be human and maybe changing, you know, us from human to something else. I think that's a question we could get into, but those are the things. And so it was understanding the beauty of how God designed the human person to be in relationship with each other and with him. And so all of that, the bioethics stuff is really just a chance to be able to talk about that with people. Maybe in a little bit more of a way that people haven't thought about it. So they're a little bit more open to listening to the truth of the church.
Can you provide just, not everybody would necessarily know exactly what bioethics is, but sort of a couple of sentences, sort of a definition of bioethics.
Yeah, so bioethics deals with the ethics, understanding the morality, the right and wrong of all of the questions about, you know, medical interaction. So it could include and does include the clinical interaction between a patient and a physician. That's something that a professional PhD having bioethicists in hospitals really focus on a lot. And they also, especially in hospitals, they focus on end of life issues, usually navigating those differences. Right. And they sometimes become sort of like quasi therapists to navigate end of life issues with between families and doctors and life support and things like that. Academically, we look at these questions. So academic bioethicists look at questions of when does brain death occur, because that has implications for organ donation, you know, because if real death is cardiac death, then there's no more heart transplants and things like that. I am more of a, I guess, a hobby bioethicist. So on the side of homeschooling my kids, I look at and research different facets of these different technologies that are coming out. You know, we have all kinds of crazy things like synthetic, quote unquote, embryos, artificial wombs. They're moving to do FDA trials with those. So things like that.
It's kind of a frightening and confusing time, right?
It is. It is. And so I really like to focus on that area, I think, because as we've seen with abortion, something that is a new or relatively new technology can become just an embedded pillar of society very quickly. And it can take a long time. Praise God, there's movement on being able to unwind that. But if we can get ahead of those things, and I think we're actually in the middle of that, sort of the IVF and reproductive, you know, egg donors and things like that, surrogacy, those things are not quite embedded as abortion, but they are definitely on their way there. And so those are some of the areas that I like to focus on. And then there's like the crazy Brave New World stuff, which you sometimes I have to look at the headline in my Google alerts and I'm like, is that real or is that some sort of like Onion or Babylon Bee site? It's just the crazy thing. Yeah. Mini brains developed and grew eyes, like things like that just don't sound possible or you know, scientists wouldn't actually be doing these things. They are. And so those are the things that I like to look at, bring to people's attention. And then if there is clear teaching from the magisterium on those things, to proclaim that loudly for people to inform them. And if there's not, to look at what has the church said, what is the church teaching about the human person, and how might we imagine or understand that to apply in these different instances.
What I sort of had in mind, like the reason why I thought it was important to bring to a homeschool podcast, is because we're all trying to teach our kids, and I think the vast majority of us would consider formation more important than information. Not that the information isn't important, not that the academics isn't important in terms of our day-to-day sort of academia that we're trying to pursue with our kids, mm-hmm. but that formation is really what this life is all about. It's definitely trumps information. And so in that world, you know, to form them, they both need information to understand I'm going to just loosely use the term bioethics, to understand the science of the human body and the dignity of the human body. But also they primarily need formation about that. So I think that I felt like Pope John Paul used this phrase in terms of marriage preparation. And he talked about the three stages of marriage preparation, right? So remote preparation, proximate preparation, immediate preparation for you know, life issues or ethical issues around the human person. So I thought maybe that would be good for us to kind of break this down in that sense as homeschool moms to, okay, so what does it mean? Because ultimately we all want to know, well, what do we do? How do we speak to our kids about sensitive issues? And they're all, this in this line, they're all sensitive issues, right? How do we handle that? We don't want to, you know, mm-hmm. overload them with information or upset them or tell them things prematurely. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, how do we lay the foundation so that we can have those conversations that are sometimes very hard later on. So I thought maybe taking that approach, sort of talking about remote preparation, mm-hmm. proximate preparation, immediate preparation. So in the marriage world, what we are talking about, remote preparation is really your family life and how that prepares you for marriage. Proximate preparation would be kind of from puberty to engagement, right? Which is in this topic, you know, would be a little bit different, but the age range would be kind of a similar age range. And then immediate preparation. So you're actually going into the adult world, you're going to face these things. How are we going to prepare them? Maybe they're going off to college for the first time, or maybe they're, you know, dating someone who's not Catholic, or, you know, who knows what situation they might be presented with. So that to me is the most important question in terms of remote preparation. How do we address family life so that we're laying a foundation for a later understanding of the ethics around a human person? Do you have some thoughts on that?
I do, but I think I'm going to want to hear you from you a little bit too, though, because like I said, my oldest is 8. So if I'm honest, I think most of these things, my experience in talking about them isn't going to be coming from my own family life, but I was a high school teacher for 8 years. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking more of how did I talk to my theology and philosophy students about these things. Right. And the one thing that I'm really excited to get into with my kids, they're not quite old enough yet, but one thing that's really, I think, helpful for breaking open these questions is the genre of dystopian fiction. And things like The Giver and Brave New World, which is the book that Brave New World, the title of the podcast, is based on. And because I think fiction is just such a beautiful and inviting way to talk about things like the nature of the human person mm-hmm. and to get to the heart of what's going on when we disrespect the human person. And you can kind of see that. So you can see implications a little bit more clearly when you have that whole world imagined for you. And so there's a few different.
Yeah, The Giver is a powerful book. In particular, and it's written to a younger crowd.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the first ones. You know, there's a few that are better for the older kids.
Well, I think in a sense, it's good, like with you at your stage of life and me at my stage of life, it's good because I think that it's important to understand kind of the theory mm-hmm. and alongside the lived experience, right? And, you know, how do we go about doing that? How do we lay a foundation? So from a sort of a theoretical or from what you've lived in your family life so far, or even looking back on your own family life, what things were the foundation or the undoing of an attitude of dignity of the human person that would set you up for later life, right?
Yeah. I think, my oldest, we have talked about abortion, and she's very staunchly pro-life. We'll drive past a Starbucks, and she knows that they give to to Planned Parenthood, and she'll say, what are you doing, people? Why are you in line there? And honestly, until I had had that conversation with her, I was still going to Starbucks. But now that she's so upset about it, I'm like, I can't go and scandalize her. I have to stand. It's forcing me to stand up for what I believe in a more consistent way. But that came up, I think, because she heard my husband and I talking about the Dobbs decision. And so then she overheard, and your little ears hear everything. And she's just constantly asking questions. This was a couple of years ago at this point. And so she was asking questions about it. And I was like, well, I mean, I don't want to tell her everything that's graphic and horrible, because it's really awful. But I also don't want to sugarcoat and not tell her the truth about the reality that's going on. So I gave her a simple explanation and direct, not pulling any punches, of what the questions that she was asking at the time. And that was enough. And then we've done a few different things that I think we've done a couple of different activities that I think have helped form the dignity of the human person in her mind. So we just participate in that baby bottle. I don't know if you guys do this at your church or different parishes, listeners. They have the Knights of Columbus pass out a baby bottle. It's not a real baby bottle, but you put money, you put change in
it. Right. Yeah. I've seen that. Yeah.
So she's very big on collecting all the extra change and the money is going to go to a pro-life center. So she's very interested in that. And then the other thing we do is, or we have done, is for Lent, and this is on a different subject than abortion, but on the dignity of the human person, we went and we used money. I forget what we took it away from. We were fasting from something, so we could use the money for, we went to the dollar store and we got a selection of items to assemble hygiene bags. And this was back when we lived in California, we much more frequently would encounter people who needed the hygiene bags. And so we'd just be driving around. I just had them in the car and we passed them out. And it was a couple of years ago, or it was more than a couple of years ago, because we've been here we moved to Idaho like 3 years ago. Right. And it's still a part of her consciousness, her imagination, because she said to me the other night, Mom, I think we were listening to Jennifer Fulweiler's audiobook, Your Blue Flame, which is basically about vocation. She's like, I think my blue flame is to serve the poor like Mother Teresa, because I really want to make hygiene bags and give them out to people. And, you know, we haven't done that since then, but it just had her thinking about it. And then reading about the saints like Mother Teresa, who did work so tirelessly for the dignity of the human person. Mm-hmm. I think those concrete examples. So we've got fiction, but then also the real life examples of people who worked to uphold that, and, you know, asking questions like, why do you think somebody would give their life, to dedicate their life to doing this? Does this sound like fun work to you? Why would somebody do this? And having those conversations. I don't know. What do you think? How have you done that with your kids?
If I can backtrack for just a second. Yeah, that's beautiful. If you're comfortable sharing this, and if you're not, that's okay. But I find a lot of times parents need the words, right? Mm. So if your daughter's asking questions, you say, I was direct. Are you able to share sort of what that looked like? Because I find a lot of times, because we weren't given the words, our kids ask questions and we don't have the words, right? Yeah. So say for example, if she said, what does abortion mean? Right? How might you answer that?
So I can't remember exactly what I said, but off the top of my head, I think I would say something, and, you know, her age, like very early primary grades. Sometimes, you remember how mommy was pregnant, and remember how I had a baby in my tummy, and remember we felt the baby move and talk about and grounded in the reality of the baby. And then I would say, well, sometimes moms have a really, really, really tough time understanding, and they've been lied to, and they've been told that that baby is not a real person, and that baby's not a real baby. Beautiful. That baby's just a clump of cells, and they might have, and then I would probably go into a couple examples of just, they might have, you know, no way of providing for a baby. And because they think it's not a real baby yet, they think they can stop the baby from coming to be. and they've been lied to, and it's not true. Mm-hmm. And so some gentle of the doctors language, have been lied yeah. to too. Yeah.
And so direct and gentle, right? You know, and again, that's very age appropriate, because like some people might have an 8-year-old that would be really upsetting, or they would jump to mm-hmm. all kinds of conclusions or whatever. And I'm just putting this out there for my listeners, like, you know, be really sensitive, because that was for you at 8 o'clock, at eight, mm-hmm. 8 years of age. For somebody else, it could be 10 or 12. For another child, it might be 6. And you have to be really kind of careful about their sensitivity,
right.
You know, yeah, as we answer those too. Questions. And those are beautiful answers. Thank you for sharing that, because I think often we just get frozen. It's the sexuality is the same. We just get frozen as parents. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how to answer the question. And we really have to develop kind of tools in our parenting toolbox. And I've said this before on my podcast, but if your child asks you a question that you don't feel prepared to answer, you know, whether that's, you know, where do babies come from, or what does abortion mean, or whatever, it's okay to say, that's a complicated question, and I'd like to think about it before I answer it, and give yourself some time to think about it and how you would like to say it. So that you can come back to the child and say it, but do come back. Like, don't use that as an evasion, thinking, okay, well, they're going to ask me again someday, so I'll be fine. But, you know, remember that, that question that you asked me, could we talk about that now? I've just sort of thought about, because it's a kind of a complicated question, I'd like to, talk about it now while there's not other kids around, or whatever.
Yeah. Usually that's mine. Let's talk about that with dad when the other kids are not. Usually it's in the car. Let's talk about that with dad.
Mm-hmm. And then we don't feel like deer in the headlights about a question and either overanswer it or don't answer it. Right. But I would say that we would answer those kinds of questions similarly. And I would also say that the more kids you have, when you've got teenagers and older kids in the house, the younger kids like kind of get dialed into those conversations sooner, depending on their sensitivity level. Sometimes that's harder or whatever, but it's almost unavoidable that they start to hear about things at an earlier age. Where we only have young kids, it's kind of easier to keep a bit of a cap on that. And then, not that we, you know, want to cap it, but we, you know, we just want to be careful about how we say things. So, mm-hmm. having older kids, I think one of the nice things is when you've used gentle language and appropriate language and respectful language, I'm going to use sexuality as the example here. So for example, if you refer to intercourse in marriage as intimacy, and if you refer to, really, we need to look at Pope John Paul for our language, because he was so, he gave the language so much dignity and shared that with us in his writing, that then we can talk about sexuality in an appropriate way. And then your older kids have that. It's a tool in their toolbox, right? And so in front of their younger siblings, they're talking more appropriately. They're maybe talking about the subject matter might be a bigger subject than your other kids had when they were 5 or 6 or 7. But it is just one of the realities of something like that. Yeah, it's great. So yeah, those are all beautiful suggestions about ways we can, because we need to approach it from two angles. This is what's not okay, and this is what's super okay, right? One of the things that I was thinking about sort of this conversation is that really a love of babies, right? And a love of, you know, being excited about when a baby's coming into the world and really drawing them into that world. And taking a meal to someone who's had a baby and really celebrating the baby, but even beyond baby, like really celebrating when your toddlers are annoying and irritating.
Well, that never happens.
Or whatever, that we celebrate children and we don't see them as a burden and as a, and not, you know, and sometimes we have to vent. That's a reality. Sometimes we have to vent as parents to our spouse or to a friend or whatever. But venting about our challenges in motherhood is a burden, I think. I think it's a burden for children to overhear all of that. I think it makes them feel like it's all too much. The children, are too much for us to handle. And I feel like that's something that could be very counterproductive. And I mean, we all lose our cool occasionally and whatever. You know, we're never going to be perfect parents. I think when the way that we show love and dignity of little people, that we, and we don't think, oh, you're a terror, because we can talk in quite, even though we might not, you know, mean it, in a sense, we can talk in quite vulgar ways about children and how they're behaving, like, oh, that little, you know, rugrat, or that little, like, and they'll hear that out in the world. But we as parents should be really, I think, really guarded about how we speak. And then if we do mess up, that we need to be saying, I never should have said that. I never should have, been so frustrated with the toddler. I never should have, yelled at you or yelled at the toddler, whatever. So, I mean, for me, often apologies in terms of when I, lost it or whatever, I would like to bring the family into that, because, that was a misbehavior on my part. So I want to apologize to the child, but I also want my other kids to know, this is not okay. This is not dignified. It's not dignified for me, for sure. And it certainly is not putting you in a place of dignity, right? And we need to treat everybody with dignity. So I think that was a big, for me, that was something that sort of loomed large in my ideals about how we can, I wasn't thinking about it. It was later on that I sort of realized that that's really does help to develop a pro-life attitude or a dignified attitude about the human person. And again, how we talk to other people, how we talk about other people. If we're offhand and like, oh, that guy's a loser, or that guy's, we should never talk like that, right? We should never be doing that as Christians, and we're all going to do it occasionally. But I think talking to, like, if I gossiped about somebody or something, saying to my kids, like, that's something I have to take to confession. That's not okay, right? It's not dignified. So, I was calling it proximate, sort of remote education. So really the education that's happening in our family lives, that's laying the foundation. It's not directly education about, bioethics, right? But it's laying a foundation that it's going to make sense later on, right?
Well, and I mean, I feel like everything is a little bit directly bioethics, mm-hmm. because we're talking about the nature of the human person. And when you're talking about respecting the dignity of people, I mean, that's formation in understanding Imago Dei and how do we see each person in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's actually much better, what we're talking about, of seeing and practicing treating each other with kindness, mm-hmm. and seeing Jesus in the face of the other. That's much better practice in formation in the Imago Dei than all of the formal arguments, mm-hmm. and everything. It's knowing that in your soul, this is how we treat people, and that's not, because I know, because mom showed me, mom failed at it and said sorry for it, because that is something, I mean, it's that saying of people will not always remember what you said, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. Mm-hmm. So being able to model that, and model that so much that they habituate themselves, mm-hmm. and they're trained in that virtue of respecting the other person. Mm-hmm. And so then when we do have those conversations about something like abortion, that when we're talking about, whether we're talking about the baby or the mother or the father or the doctor who's performing the abortion, right. that each one of them, they might be doing something that is marring how that image of God is coming through, but we can never forget that they are the image of God, and how can we affirm that and love that properly, mm-hmm. which sometimes means correction, but how can we always keep that in mind, respect that, and know that when we're having a conversation with them or about them, that person who's maybe trapped in sin, that person's not the enemy. Mm-hmm. There is an enemy. That person, if they're trapped in sin, that they are captive, mm-hmm. and it's part of our evangelical call to witness Christ to them and to help pull them out of that. And that might apply in different ways depending on a relationship with, mm-hmm. the person. But
yeah, that's beautiful, beautiful thought. Something else just popped into my head. What was it? Like sexuality, we answer that. I mean, babies often, your kids often say, where do babies come from? And all they really want to know is how does the baby get there? They don't actually want to know the biology, right? And we have a tendency to over answer. So we have to kind of think about what they're actually asking. Where do babies come from? Oh, well, God allows life to happen, and he he allows a baby to grow in my womb. And sometimes that's all they want to know. And they will ask you more pointed questions as they get older. And I think that would be and this is probably as we're sort of moving into kind of proximate education, like that education in marriage that would be sort of from puberty to engagement, that, you know, sort of young adulthood, that the question will come up. They might know what abortion is. They might understand that the baby dies. But how do we answer then their questions that become a little more pointed? Well, how do they do that, right? How do they get rid of the baby? How do they, you know, how do they kill the baby? I've had kids ask me that direct mm-hmm. question. How do they kill the baby? And that's something that we have found anyways. I don't know if that's come up when you're with your daughter yet, but that when that question came up, and inevitably it will, like, well, how does the sperm get to the egg? How do we answer that mm-hmm. question? That, you know, we have said, you know, it's upsetting, how that happens. And I will tell you, but it is disturbing and it can be upsetting. And, if you want to understand that, you know, we can tell it in sort of gloss terms, like a doctor does an operation or something like that. We can say it in sort of broad terms that are unspecific, but eventually the question will come. But I want to qualify with them and, you know, for some kids, they're going to say, I don't think I'm ready to hear that. Right. And in some ways it's information I wish none of us ever had to know. Right. But that we can defer and we can prepare them. Like, this is an upsetting thing, right? And so I want you to, if you believe you're ready to hear the answer to that question, I just want you to understand that it's upsetting and it's okay to feel hurt and angry, right? When these questions come up, right? It's okay to if you want to hear the answer to that question, it's okay for it to be disturbing, right? That doesn't make you a weak person. That makes you a person full of love. So as we move into this, I think it'd be interesting because I didn't realize you taught high school. So very much, you're very much in that proximate education age, right? What did you teach?
Taught theology and philosophy.
Oh, okay. So that would have definitely come into those conversations, right? Mm-hmm. So what did that look like? Were you teaching kids who, first of all, already had good formation, or were you in a setting that was kids? This was all new information for them in terms of theology.
So the population at the high school where I taught, it was a large Catholic high school in South Orange County, which is a generally very wealthy area. And mm-hmm. the specific city that I was in was a specifically wealthy area. So there okay. were a good number of families who were there because they wanted a Catholic education. And there were a much right. larger number of families who were there because they wanted a less expensive academics, athletics, Ivy League prep,
right,
education, and it's a little bit. I mean, it was a little bit more affordable than the non-Catholic version because the diocese mm-hmm. subsidizes the tuition,
right,
and pays for it, which is sometimes shocking to families because they're like, "We're already paying so much. What do you mean this is not the market price? This is expensive." I know it's very expensive if the diocese is not helping out. But
do they have to be Catholic?
No, I don't know that they even were majority Catholic. There was a large percentage that were Catholic in name. They got a small tuition discount if they actually actively attended a Catholic parish or could get a priest to sign that they attended a Catholic parish. And so the kids who were there, you know, they struggled a lot more. I didn't have a lot of behavior problems in class. You know, I think I can remember the names and faces of each kid and the instances that happened.
Right. Okay.
What they struggled with much more was anxiety and depression and you know, some of those harder drug uses right. that would come up at parties and things like that, because they were very much, you know, growing up a little bit too fast, and it was kind of like they were already in college, some of them, not all of them. There were a lot of really good families, really good kids, but okay. there were 1,700 kids, so there was a range.
So, for all intents and purposes, Catholic but secular.
Yeah, so Catholic but secular, and even the Catholic students, I just saw this thing online right. the other day, and there okay. was a. It was about parenting and keeping the house clean, when you're a mom, and it was a man with a mop on the beach trying to mop up the waves. And like the waves kept coming, and there's just this like onslaught. You're okay, buddy. You're never gonna. And that was about cleaning the house. But I, when you're talking, in some ways, I feel like that's what we were trying to do as the religion department and campus ministry with this population of some Catholic, some not students who were such beautiful souls, but there's just this onslaught of cultural messaging coming at them. And here we are with our mop, like trying to do our best to give them something, something solid to hold on to and real, but we only have them, you know, not even 4 hours a week. So, and that's just the time we had in front of them. Not even necessarily the time. I mean, how much of that 50-minute class are you actually reaching and a student? And then there's 30 other students. It was. I'm very grateful to be homeschooling now.
You avoid. I mean, it's, you know, we've taken on a big challenge to homeschool our kids, but to avoid all of that, it seems like the debriefing that would be necessary to actually get through the school system would be just so intense. It's going to take as much time as it takes to homeschool our kids.
Yeah. And I mean, there's, I don't want to demonize it because there really is so much good, especially for families whose lives look differently or who are called to something else. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those kids are just a light to the other kids in the classroom. So I don't want to say all negative things about that.
For sure.
Because there are some really great and beautiful moments teaching. But a lot of them came in. And at least with abortion, most of them came from conservative families. So they were usually on board, but there were also, you know, it's California. There's a range of opinions on that. And there was a range of investment in those moral questions too, because there was a lot of apathy of, you know, just what do I have to say to get the right answer on the test? Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to tell, even for me as their teacher, what exactly they believe, because most of the kids at that school were like, I have to get an A. I want to go to an Ivy League school. What do I have to do? And we had a really large population of, we had a large percentage of international students, most of whom were Chinese students. So they had grown up with no exposure to religion, no, even the cultural stuff that our other kids are. Our American kids they absorb it from growing up.
Right.
They didn't have that, but they would write, you know, word for word, whatever the textbook was, cause they had memorized it, but I don't know how much they actually were internalizing it. It was, this is what I have to say to get an A.
So what would be sort of the parallel if you were presenting the information about the dignity of the human person, how that might look with a well-formed 14 or 15-year-old compared to how it might look with the high school students that you were presented with? Like how, what would you have, I guess what I'm asking is, what would you have liked to have been able to present to them?
I mean, I think it would have been the same in starting out, in that I would have started with something that would get to the heart of the matter. So finding some sort of example where they could emotionally connect to what was going on.
Smart, yeah.
Emotionally connect to, that's an injustice. Okay, why is it an injustice? Let's break this down and look at this example in that way. Or, wow, Mother Teresa is a great example. She has fascinated the world through time. Because of she has lived out treating people with Imago Dei and refused to let go of that. And we could look at her example of her life and talk about the Imago Dei and then say, look, this is what she says about abortion. Why does she say that about abortion? Mm. Is she right? If she's right about, you know, the way that we should treat the poor and how we affirm people's dignity. And so I think it's by conversation. I think starting with those emotional examples and conversation, and then move into, okay, here's what the church says. Here's the framework. Here's a quotation from John Paul II. Here's a quotation from the Catechism. Here's what the church does. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times people who are trying to attack the church say, well, you say that, but you don't do, or this is a common attack against right. pro-life people. You say that, but how many babies have you adopted? Well, if that's going to be your argument, let's look at Catholic pregnancy centers or just Christian pregnancy centers. Yeah. And then let's look at Planned Parenthood and see how many mothers have been helped to mother their babies.
Yeah.
See how many people have been given a choice
yeah.
to choose life. How many people have they been supported and what concrete actions. And actually, that's a good question. Let's look at how many Christian families do adopt. And let's look at how many, you know, things like that. And
yeah. Yeah, it could, because people, I mean, the thing is just a lot of ignorance surrounding the topic, right? So if we can bring those things up, yeah, it's fantastic. Does Bernard Nathanson ever come up in your sort of conversations when you were teaching high school? Was that ever sort of somebody that...
Was he a former abortionist?
Yeah, and then he converted to Catholicism.
I just recently learned about him.
Okay. In our sort of early Catholic years, my husband, I'm a convert, my husband's a revert. So like in the 90s when this was all happening, this was a huge deal, right? That he, so it was something that we, you know, had conversations about on a few occasions because he had this lived experience, was living this thing and saw the advancements in technology and saw a real living baby on ultrasound and realized that there was something very deeply disturbing about what he was doing. Not that he didn't know that, but it was just another affirmation, you know. So his story is really interesting from somebody who's lived both sides.
Like Abby Johnson.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was just, he was just kind of an example, kind of like Mother Teresa. He was kind of an example of like, okay, this, he's actually living this thing. So he moved from being an abortionist doctor, having a conversion, to being a person who speaks out against abortion. Right. And, you know, that was just, I don't know, it's just like a powerful story.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, More recently, I think Abby Johnson.
Mm-hmm. So, yes.
From Unplanned is her memoir. And the Walls Are Talking, I think, was her follow-up to that.
Oh, I never heard that. Okay.
It's a good one. It has not just some of hers, but from other people and their testimony of having left and what they saw where they were there. And I think it's many of them are anonymous because they don't want to.
Yeah.
Have that pushback.
Yeah.
That's
actually a really neat thought, because there are a couple of movies out there that are innately pro-life. That one's obviously more overt, Unplanned, but, and Abby Johnson's story as well, just as a speaker and writer, but the movie Bella, right. Yeah. It's just a beautiful story. But there's a couple of other movies that I'm just thinking were never intended, I don't think, to be pro-life. The Giver actually being one of them. The book, I think the book is far better than the movie, but the movie's decent.
Are.
Yeah. And also, you know, even some movies like that I often think, wow, I didn't really realize it had such a pro-life theme to it. But the movie, have you seen the movie No Reservations?
No. I can picture the... like cover of it, but I haven't watched
it. So the woman has a career as a very high end chef, and her sister dies, and she adopts the sister's daughter, and it's hard, right? And so it's not directly pro life, but it's certainly about, you know, taking on this difficulty that at some point would just be like, okay, I just have a new problem, to I have someone to love, right? Mm-hmm. And the transition from this is a problem to this is someone that I love is really beautiful. Right. And it's, you know, not kind of a romantic comedy, but it's still, and there's a few movies like that would definitely sort of fall into that category about how we treat others and how we, life's not disposable. The mm-hmm. old movie, 12 Angry Men, fantastic movie for teenagers. So are you familiar?
I'm familiar, but it's been a while. We have it. It's just been a while since I watched it.
Mm-hmm. It's an old movie from the 60s. Really beautiful. It's all black and white. And there's a young boy who's been committed, who's been, you know, a teenager, who's been accused of a crime, who will receive a death sentence if he is accused. So it's by jury. So it's basically the entire movie is 12 men in a jury room trying to hammer out whether this guy's innocent or not. And it starts off where several of the characters, it's very much a character study, but it also really encompasses kind of this, we're talking about somebody's life here. Because at the beginning, there's three or four of the characters, it's a very throwaway thing. Like, of course he did it, right? Of course he did it. He's a black teenage kid. Obviously he did it. And then slowly they kind of come around because of somebody, one of the jurors, just being really, really sensitive to finding the truth about the matter, not assumption. He's just trying to put a shadow of doubt in these people's minds, because this is a boy's life we're talking about, right? So it's a really good movie for teens on many levels.
Another one that I would suggest that it's been a while. I used to show it to all my sophomore students. It's the same company, production company that did Bella. It's very short, maybe 20-minute short film called The Butterfly Circus.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
And you can watch it online. I think it's on Vimeo.
Okay.
And if you just Google it, it will come up. But there's a motivational speaker who is the main actor.
Okay.
And I don't remember the name of the speaker who plays the main character in The Butterfly Circus, but he has no arms and no legs.
Okay.
And so it starts off with this, and it's set in the Depression era, you know, the era where we had circus, you know, freak shows, sideshows.
Right, yeah.
And people who are different are in these freak shows. Right. And he tries to get a job at the circus, and he expects that he's going to be part of the freak show. And the ringleader is like, no, we don't do that here. And he's like, what do you mean we don't do that here? And so it kind of goes on this journey of how he discovers his own dignity and then helps irradiate that to others. It's really beautiful. You will cry. Okay. If you don't cry, you don't have a heart. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. People are differently emotive. But it's very, like I said, using that fiction to get to the heart of the matter, if you want one that moves people and helps them understand straight, because we can know everything in our heads, but that 18 inches from the head to the heart is sometimes the longest distance. So getting to that emotive state, oh, I really understand. Mm-hmm. Not just, I think there's two different Spanish verbs for to know, and I forget which one is which. There's like, no, I forget what they are now, but there's one that means to know something in your head, and there's one that means to like really know it. Okay. And wish I was remembering my Spanish now, but and so I think it's like saber and conocer, maybe. I don't know. Somebody who speaks Spanish and listening will correct me and be like, no, it's not. It's this, you idiot. Be like, don't call me an idiot. That doesn't affirm my dignity as a person.
Yeah. Would there be any other books? Like, I'm thinking Homeschool Families. Would there be any other books, whether fiction or nonfiction, that might be good recommendations for people as their kids head into those teen young adult years that you might recommend? Like Mother Teresa, any of Mother Teresa's work would be really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I think this is for older or very mature, high level teens, but the Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis is very short, but very powerful and will help. I mean, he was prophetic in seeing the way the world will unfold. So he talks about what happens when we divorce what we should do from just, can we do this? And how eventually, you know, man's power over nature just becomes man's power over other men, and how that control develops. I think that one is really key. What else would I say? I'd have to send you a link to it, but there is a good unit study on sort of dystopian fiction that I will send you. It's an independent company that comes up with different unit studies, and I can send that link to you.
Okay. There's a gal, this is just making me think, there's a gal in who has a book, who has a website called Great Books for Catholic Kids, I think it's called. Mm. And she's really good. She was she's really, really good. And she writes these really great sort of synopsis of books. And she definitely has some I know that are sort of more directed at teens. Mm-hmm. And I should look to see if there's any that sort of address this topic, because she's just so good at kind of giving you a sense of what the book is. I'm a big mm-hmm. proponent of reading aloud, especially to older kids. Like, you know, right from the get-go, we read to our kids, but don't stop reading aloud, because you can address literature or difficult topics on a much higher level when you're actually reading aloud, because you're there to guide them, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's look that up. Let's see what the church says. Let's discuss mm-hmm. this, you know, disturbing thing that's happening. And I think that that's such a gift as homeschooling families, to be able to read aloud and shape our children and shape the culture just by what we choose to read together, right?
Yeah. Yeah. This is not fiction, but Evangelium Vitae by John Paul II is phenomenal.
Okay.
And I would, of all of the documents, there are different ones you could look at if you just want to look at reproductive technologies or things like that. But that is the one that I would say is the overarching pro-life bioethics text, that if you read one, you should read this one, I would recommend, in terms of academic theological study. Just in terms of academic theological study, that's the one I would recommend.
One of the books that I'm sure you have lots you can recommend, because this would have now been your formation as a young person mm-hmm. going to college or whatever, but the idea of sort of immediate preparation. So again, comparing it to sort of marriage analogy, that just before mm-hmm. somebody's going to get married, there's going to be a certain amount of preparation for, you know, sexual encounter and sexual morality and all of that that you're going to have with them yeah. in the months coming up to marriage. Again, we're sending our children out into the world, or they're preparing for marriage. They're, you know, the two are sort of really joined together in a sense, right? Our attitudes about
yeah.
the ethics in the dignity of the human person. And the book that I've recommended to my kids mm-hmm. To read when they're in relationship and they look like they're preparing, you know, starting to prepare for marriage, that is Love and Responsibility. And it's a bit heavy, but like, any college-age student can handle it. You know, you just have to, Pope John Paul can be a little pithy. But I would say that I would recommend parents, as their kids are getting into the teen years, or even earlier if you can, read Love and Responsibility, because it just gives you so much language to be able to discuss difficult things with your kids. And just such a beautiful sort of a preparative book for marriage and relationship, and I think even relationship with other people not just your relationship with your spouse to be, right? And what would you recommend in terms of the books that maybe had an impact on you, or resources that had an impact on you, sort of at that adult now ready to face the world stage?
Yeah. So on the topic of abortion, being able to just mm-hmm. be equipped with the best arguments against abortion, I have to recommend The Ethics of Abortion by Dr. Chris Kaser. And then the other book, I'm actually going to recommend two of his books. The other book I would recommend is The Seven Big Myths About Marriage. I'm going to recommend one of his books, actually. Seven Big Myths About Marriage. It's more approachable and digestible than Love and Responsibility, and has a lot of practical statistical data that is very convincing. And Dr. Kaser, he's a Catholic philosopher. He has seven kids, but he does write a philosophy. And that book has some personal experience. I think his wife, Jennifer, co-authored it with him. But I can't recommend that enough. I used chapters with my high school students. There's a chapter on what children give to parents, which I think is so missing in our culture. There's a chapter on contraception. There's a chapter on cohabitation. So to look at, well, the myth is that if you test drive marriage, that it's going to work out, you know, better for you. Actually, that's a lie. Here's the data. And so he just breaks down everything. It's so clear. It's beautiful. And I would also recommend a very, very, very small book that he wrote, very small, for Catholic Answers. Wow, and it's okay. called How to Stay Catholic in College. So I would definitely give that to, I have given it to, you know, babysitters and things, people we know who are going off to college. And just in general, the seven, he also wrote okay. the seven big myths about the Catholic Church.
How do you spell his last name?
Just that, so I can. I think is huge. Yeah, that's actually, it's hard to spell. It's K-A-C-Z-O-R. he's not paying me to say this, but he was one of my professors in college, and I took every class that he offered. And he actually, the last one class I took from him was contemporary bioethics. Okay. And that okay. was the reason that I went into bioethics.
Well, yeah, because I think that when we reach that point, I mean, there's conversations obviously that we can have, but presumably by the time our kids are ready to leave the house, we've had the conversations, right? You know, 16, 17, 18, 20. Mm-hmm. That's the time when you want to make sure you've had those conversations. And again, you know, one 17-year-old might be more sensitive to another, and that might be a conversation that has to wait a little longer. But in terms of presenting sort of, and your kids will push back sometimes, right? Your kids will push back sometimes, and that's okay. Don't, we have to be careful about not seeing our kids questioning things as rejecting things. We are the Catholic Church. We should be able to question everything. Right? If this is where truth lies, there is no problem here. And if you don't have the answers, it's okay. Again, going back to your little kid asking you a question. If you don't have the answers, say, you know what? I'm not very well versed on this topic, but I know where I can get the resources, and I'll get some resources and we can talk about it. Maybe we could read a book together or something like that, and we can hash this out, right? Or here's a couple of, you know, apologists that you should listen to or whatever. You know, we're not always going to be the ones that convince them of something, right? Sometimes it takes somebody outside of our family to really be the voice that makes them understand something more clearly than we might have addressed it in family life, right? So, yeah, don't make the mistake of thinking questioning is rejecting, because we have to question, and question is what allows us to accept things, right? Mm-hmm. If our kids were just blindly accepting everything, that's not actually good. And that really comes like for anywhere between 12 and 20, that, you know, there's a lot of questioning depending on the kid, but that's good, right? Question away.
Yeah. I remember having a conversation with one of my good friends. He's in college and he's now a priest, but he was really worried about his sister at the time. And he's just saying, like, could you just pray for me? Cause she's going off on this path. Could you just pray for me to love her freely and to support her through this? And then I just talked to him the other day, and she and her husband, they had a kid, and they baptized the child, a baby, in the Catholic Church. And she's two now. And they were driving. He went for a visit. They were driving past, and she goes, the little two-year-old goes, "That's my church." Aww. So he's like, they really had this beautiful period of questioning together and reversion, she and her husband. And so, like, praise God, you know, I think sometimes we can be tempted to think that the present moment is all there is, and that can make us feel really desperate. Mm-hmm. And maybe more aggressive or something, which is allowing for patience, and knowing this is not the end of the story, and letting God's grace unfold how it will, and just being there for our little part, whatever our, you know, five loaves and two fish
are. Exactly. And if we get our back up about our kids questioning, even if your child is rejecting, your adult child or adolescent child is rejecting something that, you know, I just don't believe that, you know, Jesus could possibly be real in the Eucharist, that he's actually present in the Eucharist. That's ridiculous. Whatever. If they were rejecting that, outwardly rejecting that, coming down on them or ostracizing them, or doing anything that gets in the way of your relationship is only going to make it harder to get them back on track. Right. You know, you need to just keep on loving them, keep on supporting them, and, you know, be willing to have the conversations with them, even if they're hard. And you can be honest, like if they, you know, say, oh, they probably, you know, don't like this. Well, no, I don't like that that this is difficult for you to take in, but I respect you as a person. You got to go through what you go through, right? And that can be really, really challenging parenting adults, right? Parenting young adults and adults, right? That can be really challenging to just keep on loving them and not let them annoy you, because you have to keep your end open all the time. Even if they're 40 and they're, you know, have rejected the church, or they're not living a life that you would like them to be living, it still is not the end of the story. We just have to keep on loving them. And it doesn't mean we can't speak truth, but we can't cut them off in a sense emotionally or from our life. And, you know, I've heard some really amazing, beautiful stories of people even who, you know, who have had a child who's come out and they are, married to somebody of the same gender or whatever. And, you know, the parents have had to negotiate like super hard things. And I've seen it handled badly and I've seen it handled beautifully, where people are able to say, you know what, you can't be at our house and share a room together. That would not be okay. But we would love to have you come and visit. You know, public displays of affection mm-hmm. around our younger children are not okay for us, but, you know, we would like to have you and your friend or whatever you want to call them in your home. Right. I'm not going to refer to them as your wife, but I respect that you guys love each other. And so there's some hard stuff people have to deal with. Right. And when you see somebody handle it really well, it's a remarkable formative thing for us as older adults. Right. Yeah. So is he working doctor?
Kayser. Okay. He's definitely a philosopher. So a lot of the arguments that he's making are not from faith, but from
Logic.
Sure, we can say logic. Yeah. Okay. They are yeah. So it depends on the book, but I would say when he is speaking, you know, with the church or in conversation with the church, is more Aquinas. I think what he is doing, especially in the ethics of abortion, he's in conversation with all the people who are arguing for abortion over the last 50 years. In the Seven Big Myths About Marriage and the Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church, he teaches a class called The Ethics of Love and Marriage. Okay. And so I think he's very in touch with the objections of our culture too. And so he has a lot of insight just from so many conversations with students about misconceptions that people have about the church and about about love and marriage, and so being able to correct and form those hopefully right out of the gate, you know, when they're coming to college.
Okay.
It's a tough class for him.
Yeah, I bet. I'd love to take that class.
It's so good. I might be wrong about this, but I think during COVID he had to put his lectures online. So they might actually be online. Okay. I don't know. I think he has his Aquinas class lectures online. Okay. I'll look it up and I'll see if I can send them to you.
Well, we've been talking for over an hour now. I feel like we could talk for another hour. This is great, but we should probably wrap up pretty soon. I wanted to ask you, is there anything that you would sort of like to leave in terms of just thoughts or advice for parents, for homeschool parents in particular, as their kids sort of are facing these tough questions, or just to Catholics in general, like as a what we can do personally, maybe for or to increase our own understanding, right?
Yeah. I don't have any advice except pray. Mm-hmm. And that sounds trite, or there can be a cop out, and you can say it that way. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is a huge mistake to underestimate the power of prayer. When we start just in our little homeschool experience, the days that we start our day in prayer and the days that we don't are dramatically different.
Right.
And Our Lady has asked us time and time and time and time and time and time again in all of these apparitions. She has come and she's the queen. Jesus has all the power and he has delegated some of it to her. And she is saying, pray the rosary. And so I cannot emphasize enough the power and the responsibility that we have to listen to what mom is saying mm-hmm. and pray the rosary with our families.
Beautiful. And actually going right back to sort of the formation in our family life, that praying for people who are pregnant, praying for, babies that aren't wanted or loved, like all of that. So that's powerful. No, it's not trite. It's powerful. Thank you for that. Where can my people find you if they wanted to listen to your podcast, or you've got two podcasts, where would they find you?
Everything, they can find everything if they go to mamapraise.com, which is M-A-M-A. Ironically, I picked that because it was easier to spell than my last name. And then I realized you still have to figure out which mama to spell. So it didn't work out the way I thought, but it's M-A-M-A, praise, like pray to the Lord, not praise the Lord, .com. And so all of the links to everything is there at mamapraise.com.
Okay, beautiful. So the link also to your Brave New Us will be there.
Yes,
okay.
That has links to both podcasts. I write two Substack newsletters, okay. And one for the Catholic mom homeschooling blog type content, and then one for there's also faithinbioethics.com is the website for my Substack that has Brave New West stuff on it, so bioethics stuff.
And please, my listeners, I'm going to recommend that you follow Samantha's Instagram account, because your Instagram account is great. Like, there's just a lot of food for thought, not just about bioethics, but about motherhood. And we actually have two separate accounts, right?
I do. Yeah. I do, because, algorithm, it's frustrating. But some people are interested in bioethics stuff. Some people are interested in mom prayer stuff. Yeah. And some people are interested in both.
Exactly,
but it's easier to reach the right people if I have to.
Yeah, no, it's great. And they're both really lovely. So thank you for that. I just want to say thank you so much for joining me. This has been really valuable and some really great practical ideas on how we can sort of proceed in our family life with the formation aspect of our homeschool life, which is really the hugest component of all. So thank you for that. And thank you for your work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be here today. It's really a blessing.
God bless. We'll talk soon.